Science, science, science. Everything is beautiful.
These are the opening lines from The Venus Hottentot, a poem by Black poet Elizabeth Alexander, which puts into conversation a scientist and his so-called object of study, the South African Xhosa woman Satya Bartman. I'm Stephanie Schaefer, and I'd like to welcome you to Lady Fiction, dedicated to reading women. Today's episode, episode 4, turns to science and therefore offers a new take on our module, Reading Women. We will look at patriarchal practices of reading, so to speak, exploiting and dissecting Black women's bodies for scientific purposes, and we will explore poetic reformulations of those women's voices in the present moment. Poetry and history intersect. And we were reminded of this very recently with the performance of Amanda Gorman at President Biden's inauguration in January 2021. Gorman is the nation's youngest inaugural poet. And in an interview with Michelle Obama, she talks about the Black Renaissance in art and she talks about poetry. And here's what she has to say. Poetry is the lens we use to interrogate the history we stand on and the future we stand for. So I'm super excited to have a guest here who will explore the subject of poetry, Black women's bodies, pasts and futures and histories with me. Dr. Christine Vogt-William from the University of Bayreuth. Christine is a widely published scholar of South Asian and African diasporic and mixed race literatures and post-colonial women's literature. And I'd like to recommend to all our listeners her monograph, Bridges, Borders, and Bodies, Transgressive Transculturality in Contemporary South Asian Diasporic Women's Novels, published with Cambridge Scholars in 2014. Christine was an interim professor for postcolonial and gender studies at Humboldt University Berlin and is currently director of gender and diversity of the Gender and Diversity Office at the University of Bayreuth. And it is so great to have you here. So hi, Christine.
Hello, it's my pleasure to be with you here tonight, Stephanie. This is an adventure indeed.
It is. It's specifically since we all have very long hair. So this is long hair women talking in the pandemic lockdown. But I'd like to begin talking with you about the opening lines of Elizabeth Alexander's poem that you read to us at the beginning. But I have to squeeze in a trigger warning to our listeners. The poems we will discuss concern body matters and medical procedures, and we will explore the language used for negotiating the hurt done to Black people. We want listeners to know about this, but we also think that it's the key to poetry's potential to move people, with Amanda Gorman, to kind of interrogate, quote, the history that we stand on, unquote. So, this is it, enough talking from me. Christine, can you walk us through the beginning of Elizabeth Alexander's poem, The Venus Hottentot, and about this quote that you brought us, is science beautiful?
Well, I think we need to consider how these poems can actually be aesthetic sites where critical thinking has to take place. We talk about voices in these poems, and I think what's important here is that these voices set up by these African-American women poets who we want to sort of look at tonight, these voices are those belonging to subjects which have been silenced, right? And silenced at particular historical moments, silenced through violences imposed on them, all in the name of science. And we want to ask ourselves, what exactly is this science being used for, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And why was it necessary that certain voices had to be silenced by these particular violent impositions in order to produce knowledge which to all intents and purposes were meant to benefit people in general, right? Okay, so we might want to also keep this one question in the back of our minds. What exactly is science being used for, right? Okay, and here we've got an interesting approach to science, seen as, you know, in the sense of biological science, medicine, where we always have these particular ideas of knowledge production in these particular scientific fields, which are supposed to be some sort of beneficial or benevolent type of shaping of human life. And yet when we go back to the historicity of these particular quests for knowledge, right, we see that violence on human beings has been perpetrated. And what's interesting is that these are historical figures who were never thought of being actual historical personages with anything worth saying, right? Okay, so it's interesting here how we see Elizabeth Alexander, Marilyn Nelson, and Bettina Judd commemorating enslaved women who had been exploited by medical professionals and scientists, right? And what's interesting here is that these particular poems are actually voiced from perspectives which, as it were, can be thought to be coming from beyond the grave. Yeah, they've been imagined as speaking across the eons, as speaking across historical eras to us right now, yeah, in order to counter the violent historical moves where intended silencing is complicit in the exercise of knowledge production, right? Okay.
We need to talk a little bit about the historical figures that were never meant to be historical figures. I really like the way that you put this. So Elizabeth Alexander's poem, The Venus Hottentot, is a poem about the historic person Satya Bartman, a South African woman who came to London and then went on to Paris at the turn of the 18th century. So this is the 1790s that she arrives, and she passed away in Paris in 1815. She was made to be a curiosity to the London Society. She was exposed and exhibited in freak shows and circuses. And even after her passing, she became a subject or an object of scrutiny by Napoleon Bonaparte's chief anatomist, Cuvier. So Cuvier is the one who starts speaking in The Venus Hottentot. He's the one who says, science, 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 everything is beautiful. We hear him speaking as he presumably picks apart Satya Bartman's body. So the poem is basically about the Venus Hottentot, that's what she was called, and the afterlives that she might have. And I, when I was researching this, I found an article by Giuliana Iannaccaro from the University of Milan, who examines, quote, discursive practices in Satya Bartman's literary afterlives. And she has a list of all the texts about Satya Bartman. So, and she basically says that Bartman became a transnational icon of that exploitation that happened to Black women's bodies that were never supposed to even have a name. So today, when we go to the doctor, we don't think that any kind of medical care or cure is built on experiments. And we dwell on this so much, specifically in times of a pandemic. We rely on lots of testing of vaccines that is tested on animals and on humans. And those people who, you know, list themselves for the testing. Of course, they have different rights, but Satya Bartman and the other historical figures that we will talk about today had no rights. They had no claim to anything. So this is also, as you said, a quest for knowledge that allows us to kind of find out about the historical cases. So for those of you listeners who don't know this, Satya Bartman is the woman that this poem is about. She was called the Venus Hottentot, and she was exoticized, eroticized. And she, in the poem, she tries to be an entrepreneur. So we have two sections in the poem that put that establish a fictional dialogue between the examiner and the examined, the scientist and his object of study. And that's what I find absolutely amazing. So we start out with Cuvier saying, science, 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 everything is beautiful. Few will ever see what I see through this microscope. And then in the second part, we get Saatchi's own voice. What do you make of her own voice?
Yeah, if I could just backtrack a little bit to Cuvier again, picking up from where you left off, right? Few will ever see what I see through this microscope. So we have this idea that everything that he looks at is put under the microscope. The guy doesn't necessarily look at this woman as a person, right? And then you see interesting ways of how he fragments her, right? Okay, her genitals will float inside a labeled pickling jar in the Musée de l'Homme on a shelf above Brucker's brain, the Venus Hottentot. And he ends up with elegant facts await me. Small things in this world are mine. Right? Okay, we've got this white scientist person here who can only relate to his object of investigation, not as a subject with a mind, a heart, a life, a story, a history. No, this person is objectified, and this person is rendered small enough, fragmented enough to come under his microscope, because small things in this world are his. We notice there is this exertion of ownership. But what's interesting immediately after that is that we find Saatchi in this lyrical eye, where she talks back, and she exists outside of time. In this poem's title, she's called The Venus Hottentot, 1825. Now, this is 10 years after Sarah's death and dissection.
Yes.
Okay, so this gives us the impression that it's her ghost who is released from her body, released from linear understandings of time. The ghost appears moored, tied to the spaces that she has inhabited in her life, and that particular space right now where she's having this altercation with Cuvier. But she also floats free from such moorings, right?
And can I just jump in here? The floating, of course, is what is fascinating to me, because I'm not sure she's a ghost. She's floating disembodiedly. And I have to say this, that her genitalia were displayed in the Musée de l'Homme in Paris for almost 200 years.
Yeah.
And she was only buried at the beginning of the 2000s.
Yeah, she was buried in 2002, 187 years later. 187 years later.
How long her body was this put on display? We never knew, so viewers would never know who this person was. So
absolutely.
It's not even, I'm not sure it's ghostly, it's disembodied, it's free-floating, it's a hauntology. I don't know what to call it, but there's a wonderful concoction of that physical fluidity. Yes,
absolutely.
What would you call it?
I would definitely call Sarah's speaking here a mode of hauntology. Yeah, where she's building up a hauntological relationality with Cuvier through this poem. And this is how Alexander wants to set the stage. I mean, and the fact that she also adds in 1825, which then also speaks to us here in the 21st century, where a voice has been imagined for this dismembered woman, a voice that none of us had ever reckoned we would ever hear. And what's interesting here is that she has this self-assertive way of describing herself. As you pointed out earlier, she sees herself as the family entrepreneur.
Yes.
Now, this is quite an audacious position to be claiming for somebody who is seen as property. Small things in this world are mine, right? As a woman who perhaps not necessarily immediately thought of as being part of chattel slavery, but still was definitely in the purview of chattel slavery with regard to how her body was treated in extractivist and exploitative ways, just for the sake of a white man's pursuit of knowledge. And in that pursuit of knowledge, we find Cuvier reifying how the black female body has to be understood as a hypersexualized entity, where any mode of personhood, subjectivity, history, story, voice, memory, relationships, yeah, anything of those images or ideas of personhood, they are being disavowed. And yet, we see this woman seeing herself as an entrepreneur who has basically made this decision, as the history books have it, made this decision to go along and allow herself to be objectified with this one idea at the back of her mind that she will be earning some kind of money remittance in order to help her family advance their fortunes. This is what we
see.
She even
imagines herself to become a kind of a duchess.
Absolutely.
So she says, "I left Cape Town with a promise of revenue, half the profits in my passage home, a boon."
Yeah.
So she was, Master's brother proposed the trip. The magistrate granted me leave. So it's not like she can go wherever she wants to. She does have to seek permission. But then she says, "I would return to my family a duchess with watered silk dresses and money to grow food, rouge and powders in glass pots, silver scissors, a lorgnette, voile and tulle instead of flax, cerulean blue instead of indigo." So it really becomes an adornment of body that she imagines, and a social upward mobility that she imagines that will come from her entrepreneurship, from her mobility to the center of the empire, and from her exposing herself and making the money. So the Elizabeth Alexander gives the Venus Hottentot really an entrepreneurial character that where she seeks to adorn her female body in female ways. It's not like she wants to own a large estate. She says, "I want to have rouge and powders in glass pots, silver scissors." So she wants to wear, you know, beautiful clothes. And
yeah, well,
that's, I think, very relatable also. It's a gendered luxury that is proposed
indeed,
here.
Indeed, it is a gendered luxury that is being imagined by a black woman who has obviously heard of such luxuries being accorded to white women. And if you see, there are interesting products here that, you know, you would have basically imagined seeing on the dressing table of white women as well. So
yes,
we see here not necessarily just an upward class mobility thing here going on here. Here we would also need to see how intersectionality also works.
Yes, absolutely.
How a black woman imagines herself and imagines certain futures for herself that actually go beyond the types of discourses dictate what black people could have at that particular
yes.
time and place actually have imagined for themselves. And I see also an interesting sort of allusion here to the chattel slavery economy also in the USA. Because you talk about cerulean blue instead of indigo. And if you look at the indigo industry in the US, especially in the South, where, you know, slaves were used, enslaved peoples were used to harvest indigo so that basically this particular dye could be then used to dye clothing. Which again comes out as material luxury goods.
Yes,
but again,
and we should say also that luxury blue was an absolute luxury color. It was
the hardest
color to produce.
Absolutely,
and it was in France. It was the color reserved for the king.
Absolutely.
So it has a classist implication.
It has definitely class evocations here. But what we see here, what Alexander has basically shown us here with this particular voice of Saki Bartman, is that this is a black woman who dares to dream and dares to imagine this. Yeah. Okay. So we have somebody who's breaking boundaries here. We have somebody here who's not willing to just quietly and patiently and just sit around and do what is expected of her. And interestingly enough, while she imagines her business, or rather imagines her returning her family as a duchess, a couple of stanzas down, we see her actually also ruminating on a particular engraving called The Ball of the Duchess du Barry. Yeah?
Yes.
And in the engraving, she says, I lurch towards the beldam, mad-eyed, and they swoon. Men in capes and pince-nez shield them. Tassels dance at my hips. In this newspaper lithograph, my buttocks are shown, swollen and luminous as a planet. Again, mm-hmm. we have her basically as either, a hauntological entity or a ghost, however you wish to address this. She literally sees herself being exoticized. Tassels dance at my hips. In the engraving, I lurch mad-eyed, and they swoon. She literally sees herself imposing her body as they read it in racialized and gendered frames. This exoticized, eroticized, but yet at the same time monsterized body as well. And we see how her body again is being fragmented. I mean, it's not, on the one hand, she lurches, it is her mad eyes, but on the other hand, you've got the spotlight more or less trained on her buttocks, which is yes. what, of course, her buttocks as well as her genitalia, which Cuvier was extremely invested in. Yes? Yeah. And immediately yeah. after this, we see how she cynically observes Monsieur Cuvier, investigates between my legs, poking, prodding, sure of his hypothesis. He complains at my scent and does not think I comprehend, but I speak English, I speak Dutch, I speak a little French as well, and languages Monsieur Cuvier will never know have names, but I am bitter now, right? Okay, mm-hmm. So we have somebody here who is literally sort of watching Cuvier, his gaze trained on her. But in the interestingly enough, she inverts this gaze as well. And the next stanzas basically bring us to what she sees in this audacious, rebellious, resisting gaze. Now, there's much to be said about the privileging of the white gaze when it comes to knowledge production practices, and yeah. this is also something that we still interrogate today, especially in the frameworks of decolonial scholarship. But here we see Satya Bhatman literally decolonizing her own body from this mm-hmm. gaze by inverting this gaze, and she goes mm-hmm. in and she says, my flexible tongue and healthy mouth bewilder this man with his rotting teeth. If he were to let me rise up from this table, I'd spirit his knives and cut out his black heart, seal it with science fluid inside a bell jar, place it on a low shelf in a white man's museum, so the world could see it was shriveled and hard, geometric, deformed, unnatural.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
And that's the ending of the poem, and I just love it. Thank you for performing it for us. That's what she does. That's what the poem ends with. It doesn't end with Satya's genitalia put on the shelf. It ends with her rising up, cutting the guy's heart out, you know, the ultimate act of retribution, and then displaying to the world that he has no heart. So exactly. while her humanity is being questioned, or she's not granted human status in the scientific setup, the poem empowers her by having her cut his heart out and show and reveal him to be unhuman. And that's what I just love about the poem. So it's decolonization and turning the tables at the same time and saying science, as we understand it today, with its presumed objectivity, with its hard facts, is not only built on so many sacrifices that we don't know of, it's also built on an inhuman scientist persona.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's then, what she as it says in the end.
Yeah, there is something to be said about this inversion of that gaze and this meditation of possible violation of the scientist's body in return for the kinds of mutilation that scientist has perpetrated on this female body. herself, right? Okay, absolutely discounting, disavowing her personhood. And interestingly enough, also not even allowing her to rest in death, not even according her the dignity of that citizenship right after a life of work. We have to also realize this. While Sarah Bartman talks about entrepreneurship, she is doing work. She is literally doing labor. Yeah. And this is something that those scientific minds and white privileged scientific gazers of that time were not aware of.
Yes.
They did not see the black woman's body doing the labor that was needed. Yeah. And under which conditions that labor was being carried out. Yeah. There was no recompense. There was no recompense.
No, exactly. It was gratuitous labor, and they were subjected to gratuitous violence. So maybe this is also a good point to lead over to the second case study, so to speak, of poetic invention or reinvention of a victim of science, namely Marilyn Nelson's Fortune's Bones. So this is the case here, the person who speaks to us from beyond the grave or above the grave or through a weird embodied, disembodied poetic voice is Fortune, who was a slave in Massachusetts to a Dr. Persevere Porter, and who also became a study object of science. Maybe you can walk us a little bit through Fortune's case, and then we talk about Marilyn Nelson's poetic vision in Fortune's Bones, published in 2004.
Yes, absolutely. This is another heartbreaking case, really, of another enslaved body, a man this time, a father, a husband, and he died at the age of 60. Some accounts, they say, causes unknown. Other accounts that he had an accident and fell into the river near his home, and so on and so forth. Suffice it to say, he died, but was not allowed to rest in death. Again, another basic citizenship right, being able to rest in the long final, I don't know, journey to your next life, if you so believe, right? And this person was enslaved during the 18th century. His master, Dr. Persevere Porter, was an orthopedist. He was also a teacher. He was also somebody who trained other young medical practitioners. And what was interesting is that he seemed to have, some sort of weird attachment to to Fortune himself. So much so, he had to have his skeleton extracted from the dead body by boiling off the flesh. Again, trigger warning, this is highly upsetting, right? Okay. And he kept that skeleton in his office, in his home. And this man had other enslaved people working for him, amongst them, Fortune's wife, Dinah, who was a house slave. Now, one can only imagine what this woman must have felt like to clean around her husband's own remains, right? So it's something that's quite traumatizing. I mean, Fortune, it is to be hoped, his spirit had gone off to something better. We will hear a little bit more about that later. But to actually have your husband's skeleton in the house, in the space that you have to work in. And I have to just, say a little bit about what we find in this poem cycle, Dinah's Lament, where a black woman's voice is heard again grieving for her loved one. She says, "Miss Lydia doesn't clean the doctor room. She say she can't go in that room, she's scared. She make me take the dust rag and the broom and clean around my husband hanging there. Since she seen Fortune head in that big pot, Miss Lydia say that room make her feel ill, sick with the thought of boiling human broth. I wonder how she think it make me feel. To dust the hands what used to stroke my breast, to dust the arms what hold me when I cried, to dust where his soft lips were and his chest, what curved its warm against my back at night. Through every season, sun up to starlight, I heft, scrub, knead, one black woman alone, except for my children. The world so white, nobody know my pain but fortune bones. Now, we have here this black woman speaking, yearning for her husband. And perhaps we could take that particular poem here, Dinah's Lament, and just use it as a kind of a framing to look at the title picture of the book itself, where we have Marilyn Nelson's Fortune's Bones. We have the skeleton, and we have an imagery which was put together by some sort of computer technology, where you might actually imagine how Fortune might have looked like. And we just basically get to have this skeleton juxtaposed onto this image of this man as he was imagined in his humanity, right? But what we have here through Dinah's lament, we have this woman still imagining her husband in fleshly intimacy. This was a man she knew very intimately. She shared her hopes and dreams with, shared her fears with. She had children with this man. It was important to say at this time, they lived in circumstances which were atypical for the enslaved. Fortune, his wife Dinah, and their children were actually given a home of their own close to Preserved Porter's own estate, right? So here, interestingly enough, despite this interesting, shall we say, I don't know, an allowance of your own free home space, interestingly enough, Fortune is not buried. He's not, his family are not allowed to take part in a going away ceremony, a leave taking ceremony. They are not, they have not been able to pray or to sing. They have not been able to bury their dead according to their own customs. No. Instead, this skeletal remains are removed, repossessed, as it were, right? The skeletal remains are now put into the doctor's office to serve his own purposes. So service has not ended with death. He has not been accorded the dignity of the long eternal rest. Instead, what's interesting here is that we, on page 17, we get Dr. Preserved Porter's ruminations on a rather interesting mode of intimacy that he embarks on with this particular skeleton.
Maybe before we dive into this dialogue, again, we have a dialogue between those two figures that is imagined in the poetry. Maybe before we delve into that, I can say a few words about the project of the Manumission Requiem. So Marilyn Nelson's book is called Fortune's Bones, The Manumission Requiem, and it's a commissioned work of art. So the question here is also, how do we deal with this past that we stand on, and how do we imagine a future that we stand for, to go back to Amanda Gorman's works? So this Manumission Requiem is commissioned art, and it's the result of interdisciplinary research. So at the site, at the Meditech Museum, there was a team of anthropologists, archaeologists, and historians working with the museum staff that gave the poet insight into Fortune's life, and that did this digital reconstruction of what he might have looked like that you talked about, and that is the cover image. So we see how the digital image looks like today, what he might have looked like, and shining through, we see the bones. And the question here again is, and this is something that Nelson in the preface doesn't answer, or in the author's notes. So she says there was debate about burying the skeleton. And lots of people were in favor, saying, let him rest. You know, we've had enough art producing, scientific study around him. This has been, let's grant him what you call his citizen right. and have a burial, as they did with the remains of Satya Bhatman. But then she also says there were people who say, maybe he has other things to tell us, and maybe we should preserve the skeleton here to not only teach human anatomy, but as a memento to inquire about who has the right to bury whom, what does burial mean, and what do we do with these bodies when we meet them. So the poem goes beyond the bodies, and this is where I'm trying to sink back to what you were talking about. So we have Preserved Porter talking to us how he dissects the body in the poems, and then we also have another section that's called Not My Bones, that is Fortune's voice. And maybe we can speak about those two parts a little bit. So Preserved Porter on Abrigador Hill talks about what it's like for him to take his former possessions or the person he worked with for so many years apart.
Yeah, I would say that Preserved Porter basically was still acting in the accepted slave-owning fashion, that he still did not see Fortune as a person who had rights, who even after his death was still pressed into service, literally. Yeah, and in order to be able to be pressed into posthumous service here, he had to have his flesh boiled off, right?
Yeah.
But what's interesting in Obrigador Hill is that we, even before the business of the flesh being boiled off, we have Preserved Porter doing a type of autopsy of Fortune himself, before Fortune is reduced to bones, right, to a skeleton and pressed into service anew. But what's interesting about this is that, and here it's interesting to see how our Black women poets here are trying to accord some sort of some glimmer of humanity in these scientists, with the hope, there's a certain hope behind this exercise, this glimmer of humanity in the voices of these scientists, where there is the hope that they still might come to some sort of recognition of the violence of their pursuits of knowledge and the means with which they pursue this. And what's interesting in Obrigador Hill is that we've got Preserved Porter literally setting up a mode of intimacy with this enslaved man. And this is an interesting form of intimacy.
It's necromance also. I mean, it's taboo.
There is something distinctly in the purview of ontology. There's a necromantic type of framing going on here, with, if you take also the romantic from the necromantic into consideration,
yeah,
where he goes in with, "Herewith begins my dissection of the former body of my former slave, which served him who served me throughout his life, and now serves the advance of science. Note well how death softens the human skin, making it almost transparent, so that under my reverent knife, the first cut takes my breath away. It feels like cutting the whole world. It falls open like bridal gossamer." Now, we hear it is an interesting way of rendering this dead man's body feminized. The bridal gossamer, where there's a veil that is being removed to reveal certain mysteries that this scientist is keen on unveiling. And yet he comes back with, "And I am humbled by ignorance, humbled by ignorance." This couplet, "And I've been humbled by ignorance," occurs three times in this particular poem. So let's move on. He goes, "Standing on a new continent, beyond the boundaries of nakedness, I am forever changed by what I see." One begs the question, what is being changed in Preserved Porter, indeed? "The complex, delicate organs, fitted perfectly in their shelter of bones, the striated and smooth muscles, the beautiful integuments, the genius strokes of thumb and knee, in profound and awful intimacy, I enter fortune and he enters me. So how then do we imagine this relationality between this scientist and the enslaved man, the body that is pressed once again into service? How do we then try to find out what has changed in Dr. Preserved Porter? Does he come to see that what he has been doing and what he will do is not necessarily humane, at least to this particular black man, in observation or non-observation of his citizen rights? How does this person even try to imagine what this man's wife and children might feel? No, we do not know yet. Here, the reader is left standing on the cusp of expectation. What indeed has forever changed? We see that in Cuvier, small things are all his. Do we see Preserved Porter considering what needs to be changed in himself? History has taught us that Preserved Porter does not necessarily exhibit any form of change or reflection. No, after the dissection, he boils the flesh off Fortune's bones, and all that is left are the bones that he presses once more into service for a further 215 years. Fortune is not buried. Fortune still had to while away his time, in museums, in storerooms, in cellars, right? He was put into storage. And what happens as well is that, interestingly enough, after Marilyn Nelson actually, you know, sets up this fantastic poem, right, which she conceives of as a requiem of leave-taking, right, a laying to rest of the body. We've got spirituals, African-American spirituals that resound as well in a second line parade, very common in the American South, where both the body is mourned, the life that has passed is mourned, but yet again, the life is celebrated as well. So we see Nelson setting grief side by side with joy. Is there a mode of laying to rest here? Is there a mode of leave-taking here? And yet again, we also have Marilyn Nelson also giving Dr. Isaiah Maria Barnwell, the former baritone voice of African American women's a cappella group, Sweet Honey and the Rock. She gives her an assignment. And what happens here? Dr. Isaiah Maria Barnwell, composes an orchestral symphony with 7 soloists and a 200 strong black choir, all who perform this entire poetry cycle. And this premiered in Waterbury, Connecticut, on 9th of May, 2009. There was just one performance. Yeah. I'm hoping that there will be more performances of this particular poetry cycle. So in the end...
Can I just ask you about this here? So the poem... So, okay, the historical case, so to speak, that we only found out about after so many years, and the skeleton still not being set to rest, becomes an interdisciplinary science project at MedAttack. Marilyn Nelson writes her manumission requiem, her poetical imagination of Fortune and his master. And then this is transformed yet again into music, which it's fascinating to me how all of these artistic reformulation circulate around the body and can never actually resolve the question of the bodily existence of the essential humanity. So art here reproduces the questions and echoes things back to us that science never will and never can, because science builds on a presumed disembodied objective lens. So that's a huge point for me on the podcast also to, you know, talk about the value of art and the power of art to reproduce things back to us through using science, appropriating it and transforming it into something else. And yet, of course, the case can never be resolved. whether Fortune's bones are laid to rest or not, the evil that has been done, the exploitation that happened is on science. It's on the white master. It cannot be undone, but it can be worked through. So some kind of grief, some kind of contemporary answer or a tentative suggestion can be offered to those who listen to this requiem or those who read those different voices in one book. So you have Persever Porter's voice, you have Dinah's voice, you have Fortune's own voice. Let's quickly talk about Fortune's voice. That's the chapter, Not My Bones.
Indeed, here I have to say as well, you see how we see an interesting movement of the way Fortune, first of all, goes into this introspective sort of regarding of his own remains, right? Again, yeah. We have the impression this is a voice from beyond the grave, a hauntological entity, a ghost, a revenant, if you wish.
Can you quote it for me? You do it so beautifully. Can you read out the opening? I really want to hear you do it. That's so cool.
I was not this body. I was not these bones. The skeleton was just my temporary home. Elementary molecules converged for a breath, then danced on beyond my individual death. And I am not my body. I am not my body. We are brief incarnations. We are clouds in clothes. We are water respirators. We are how Earth knows. I bore light, passed on from an original flame. While it was in my hands, it was called by my name. But I am not my body. I am not my body.
Thank you. It is so revolutionary or rebellious, that repetition, saying, I am not my, you can bowl my bones. You can take it all apart. I am not that.
Exactly.
It doesn't say I am this, I'm a spirit, I'm a ghost, I'm still floating around. It does not say what it is. It only says I am not my body. Mm-hmm. So this is also transcending the body in a spiritual mode, in a religious mode, but also saying you don't have that power. You can't do it to me.
Exactly. And at the same time, if you notice in the second stanza, he goes from the first person singular, he moves from I to a we. He's mm-hmm. talking about community. He's mm-hmm. talking about how we as individuals cannot divorce ourselves from the idea of community. This is something that also sort of echoes what Persever Porter actually realizes when he says, when I enter into fortune and fortune enters me. We have that interesting sort of recursive reflection on what it means to be community and not necessarily just working on modes of individuality, modes of individual gain. And it's interesting here that Fortune also talks about the brevity of human life. We are brief incarnations. We are clouds in clothes. Yeah. We are water respirators. We are how Earth knows. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Fortune's ontological take on what knowledge of this Earth is. The fact that all of us, as members of this community, right, where very often the understanding of humanity and humaneness very often it only seems to be accorded to one particular group.
Yeah.
And this has been part of certain epistemological frames, right? When we talk about universal humanism, all of those discourses were generated at a time where slavery was at its peak, where certain groups were not even accorded the dignity of being named human, mm-hmm. where he says, we are how Earth knows. Yeah, and this is where knowledge is so much a part, such an intricate element of how we see ourselves and how we relate to each other, how we want to know about each other, how we want to know about the world around ourselves, right? Mm. But at the same time, there are certain knowledge producers, by virtue of their own privileged positions, they seem to have some sort of interpretive sovereignty about what constitutes proper knowledge. And yet we have a ontological presence of a former slave who died in 1798, who comes back to tell us that we are how Earth knows, and we are accountable for how Earth knows and how we know.
Yeah.
I have to perhaps also mention at this point, Fortune was indeed buried 215 years after he died, in September 2013.
Okay.
He lay in state at the Connecticut State Capitol Rotunda at Hartford, and the state police escorted him to his memorial service at the same church where he was baptized. And the director of the Matatuck Museum, Bob Burns, was extremely, you know, forthcoming in providing this information. And he also found out, according to the records, that Fortune was baptized in 1797. The memorial service was held at St. John's Episcopal Church in Waterbury, where he was baptized, and the burial took place at Riverside Cemetery, a historic cemetery full of prominent Waterbury residents. So what's interesting here is that Fortune, the enslaved man who could not have in his lifetime basically imagined being buried in the first place, we look at this in retrospect, but also buried in his former space of life, home, interaction, buried amongst prominent residents. Yes. So 215 years after his death, and the years of service after that, you know, again, a black body's labor. So again, the entire poem cycle basically allows us to reflect critically on how certain groups of people, African-American enslaved people, were basically denied their humanity, denied their citizenship rights.
It also means that we live in a world that was built on this. So this is spelling out structural racism. It's not like slavery is something that happened 200 years ago or shorter than that, and then it was ended. It's we live in a world that is built on that, that is lacking a graveyard to those who were not buried or who were used for science or for those who were enslaved. And I mean, this note to the present, this may be a good transition point also to Bettina Judd's work, the collection Patient, published in 2014. That's the third text that we want to quickly take a look at. The title reference already plays out this double meaning. It's a reference, it's called Patient. It's a reference to being patient, to bodies that endure things, but it's also a reference to the patient. So the collection is about herself going through gynecological troubles and procedures. And she takes up gynecology as a science that comes to us through history. And she resurrects the contribution of the women that were examined by one of the inaugurational figures of gynecology. And those figures, I want to say their names first: Joyce Heth, Lucy Zimmerman, Betsy Harris, Anarka Westcott. Those are the patients that paved the way for modern gynecology and ultimately allowed Bettina Judd to take control, or try to take control, over her own black female body in the present moment. So why don't you give us a quick walk through Bettina Judd's collection, Patient. It starts off with, in 2006, I had an ordeal with medicine, and then it has various chapters, pathology, use treason of the body, parody, and to the patient in the end. And we picked two or three little pieces from that.
Let me just go to this, to page one, where we start with this entire cycle. It's entitled, "In 2006, I had an ordeal with medicine." And this persona is interesting. There is no name attached, but during the course of reading this cycle, we realize that this is a black female medical researcher who is basically confronted with this interesting idea that, how does she say it in one of the stanzas, gynecology was built on the backs of black women anyway. She says this on page 9. But let's just go back to this first poem here. "I must have been found guilty of something. I don't feel innocent here lurking with ghosts. See, it happens like that. I start at a thought that is quite benign and end up peccant, debased. I had an ordeal with medicine and was found innocent or guilty. It feels the same because I live in a haunted house. A house can be a dynasty, a bloodline, a body. There was punishment, like the way the body is murdered by its own weight when lynched. Not that I was wrong, but that verdicts come in a bloodline. In 2006, I had an ordeal with medicine. To recover, I learn why ghosts come to me. The research question is, why am I patient?" And here, what I find highly fascinating here is that it seems to be a moment of awakening. Yeah, she feels innocent or guilty. What would she be guilty of? What would she be innocent of? This is a researcher. What kind of an ordeal does she have here with medicine? I believe that ordeal is in the realization of the fact that in the course of her research, she realizes that while she is now currently in 2006 in that privileged position as a black woman medical researcher, the work that she's doing, the privilege of research that she is now engaged with, is standing on the backs of enslaved black women, her ancestral foremothers, if you will, and how they have contributed to the science of gynecology. How did they contribute with their bodies, with their minds, with their personalities? Yeah, how did they contribute to the rudiments of gynecology? Right? She ends with that very, very interesting question. And she calls this a research question. Now, research questions are very, very important for all of us, I'm sure.
For all people in the world in academia, yeah, research questions are key. So pipe up, everyone.
Exactly. Research questions also show us how we have command of certain grammars and vocabularies in certain disciplines in order to engage with the types of work that need to be done to produce knowledge. And especially if it comes to gynecology, it concerns women's reproductive health. It concerns women's reproductive organs. Again, this particular field of research is also envisaged as something that produces knowledge to help with that very, very mysterious, if you want to call it that, mysterious exercise of producing children of one's own body with the specific reproductive organs that have been endowed to women. Yeah. So essentially here, we want to ask ourselves, she says that she lives in a haunted house, and she talks about a house can be a dynasty, a bloodline, and a body. Using the idea of a bloodline, using the idea of a dynasty, we might want to talk about maternal genealogies here. Mm. We want to talk about a certain epistemological bloodline here. Yeah. Because let's face it, black women's blood flowed into the charting of this particular science. We might even say black women's blood was the ink that was used to write these particular treatises on reproductive organs, reproductive sciences, and reproductive health. Mm. So let's talk about this sort of ontologies, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about who are the people who were historically involved here, right? And in doing so, we then realize as well how the research question that this particular poetic persona of 2006, why am I patient? Again, you have that double entendre. Why am I being patient? Why am I being steadfast and resolve? I'm not rushing towards results. I have taken the time to look at these historical figures. And at the same time, I would also perhaps have to entertain the idea that I, as a black woman, might also have to be a patient, a person being treated for an illness as well.
And this is maybe a good point to also point to two things. So one is the question of black women's reproductive health. And this is, I'm super happy to have you here because I know you work on this as well. Christine has a conference coming up on this. So there's a double standard, to say the least, when it comes to getting treatment, getting care under childbirth and these topics. We don't have time to dwell on this, but I recommend that you check this out to our listeners if you're interested. And the second point is, again, how do we engage the logic of onlooker, scientist versus object of science or patient? And this might be something that lots of people can relate to these days, talking about a pandemic, getting vaccinated, not getting vaccinated. Are we patients or are we citizens? And who gets the right to be vaccinated and when? So, Bettina Jett resolves this question by giving agency or empowering the silenced women who helped gynecology on the way. She has chapters that are called The Researcher Discovers Anarka, Betsy, and Lucy. And then Lucy, Betsy, and Anarka do some discovering themselves. So Joyce Heth, for instance, presents The Showman as Dentist. Or Betsy invents the speculum, or Lucy is found on the train. So throughout the poetry collection, she inverts that relationship, that powerful gaze, and gives voice, names, and empowerment to the women whose bodies served as models. And maybe we can quickly look at Betsy invents the speculum to kind of wrap it up a little bit and come to the present moment.
I'd just like to just say a little bit about the one poem that you mentioned earlier, The Researcher Discovers Anarka, Betsy, and Lucy, because I think this has salience to who the other interlocutor in this conversation should be, and that would be Dr. James Marion Sims, who is the gynecologist who does the actual experiments on Lucy, Anarka, and Betsy. And this person is someone who needs to be also carefully considered in ways that we have looked at Preserved Porter and Georges Cuvier as well. Having said that, a little bit of what, for example, Harriet Washington has observed of James Marion Sims' ways of doing knowledge or producing knowledge in her 2006 book, Medical Apartheid. In fact, the very fact that you've got this researcher persona from 2006 and the fact that Harriet Washington's book came out in 2006, in some ways, while rereading all these poems and looking at the researcher figure again, I was tempted to think that this researcher figure might actually allude to Harriet Washington, who also talks about interesting similar moments of realization in her own research while she was writing Medical Apartheid. But that's just me. Please don't quote me on that. But there is something that is worth looking at. And I quote, she says, and this is talking about James Marion Sims. Public opinion, she says, would tolerate surgical experiments, operations and processes performed upon slaves, which it would execrate if performed upon their masters. Such pointed criticism may help to explain why some physician scientists who spoke candidly of injecting, dosing, or performing revolutionary surgeries on their slave patients in the first half of the 19th century expressed their actions more guardedly in their later writings. For example, Dr. James Marion Sims eventually hid his subject's race and even illustrated reports of experiments on black slave women with illustrations of bourgeois white matrons. Journals sometimes dispensed with racial labels, although their articles still offered broad social cues about their subjects' ethnicity. Language was often tortured to disguise the racial nature of hazardous experimentations. Unquote.
This is ideal because it shows us that the poetry at the same time informs us about things that we didn't know. And that's key in unearthing a criticism of the history of science.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's empowering in that it asks us to ask, how did the sample come about? It makes us also a little lay researchers, if need be, while at the same time, you know, giving responsibility back to us and making us become more than just a patient on a chair.
Yeah, and if we come back to the poem again, that last part, the researcher discovers Anaka, Betsy, and Lucy. She says, in these three, Sims shapes his speculum, invents his silver sutures, perfects protocol for proper handling of the female pelvis.
Mm.
Unanesthetized or addicted to opium, children born, children disappeared, helpless help. And here we see Sims again, and this reminds us of Preserved Porter's fascination and his intimacy with Fortune's remains, right? I entered fortune and fortune enters me, right? And then we have Georges Cuvier's Small Things Are Mine. Mm. And here we have Sims, who's only interested in his speculum, his invention of his silver sutures, and the perfect protocol for the proper handling of the female pelvis. Again, the female body is being fragmented, right? That pelvis, the female pelvic region, is the site where knowledge is produced and found narrated, right?
Or maybe even the site where Preserved Porter Nelson's poem imagines himself as the great discoverer.
Absolutely.
I mean, remember that quote about, I stand on the continent.
Absolutely.
And I mean, that crumbles 250 years of, or 500 years of settler colonialism into and onto the woman's body.
Absolutely.
Where I mean, the male discoverer comes and takes it and does as he pleases with it.
Absolutely. And then, of course, the products of the reproductive system, children born, children disappeared, right?
Yeah.
Okay. How did they figure in to this relationality? Obviously, Sims wasn't necessarily interested in black children being born. Mm. Okay. We have several poems in this particular cycle where you have Lucy and Anaka and Joyce speaking to their children who are either unborn or born dead, or who have passed on afterwards. They, in some cases, they literally beg their children's forgiveness for what they have had to endure. And which then brings me back to the question of labor, of work, black women's work. This part of, this last part, helpless help. We have the idea of the help, for example, the domestic enslaved woman who now has to use a different mode of labor, unlike Dinah, who has to dust around Fortune's bones. We have people like Anaka, Lucy, and Betsy having to perform a different kind of labor. And the poem that you addressed, that we wanted to talk about here, Betsy invents the speculum, right? And this is a key moment in J. Marion Sims's life. I mean, we also have an interesting excerpt from his The Story of My Life, J. Marion Sims, where he's basically interested in recording all these highlights, the greatest hits of his own lifetime of knowledge production.
greatest hits.
Absolutely. Introducing the bent handle of the spoon, I saw everything as no man have ever seen before. Mm. I mean, seriously.
The discovery. I love the discovery. Again, it's all again. Out there. It's exactly. Like outer space.
Absolutely.
Or inner space. Yeah.
Preserved porter standing on the edge of the continent about to explore, about to discover. And what's interesting here as well, he's got the bent handle of a spoon. A bent handle of the spoon that he saw everything as no man had seen before. Again, we've got the white male gaze, the patriarchal gaze, the knowledge-producing gaze, right? Where he has interpretive sovereignty. And what's interesting here with the idea of a spoon, which he probably improvised to produce that initial model of a speculum. And yet a spoon is an instrument to ingest food. We have a rather ghoulish, haunting, ghostly type of image here where we have the scientist who is ready to consume the black female body in order to find the knowledge he so desires and craves. And yet we have Betsy's voice coming back here. We have, I have bent in other ways to open the body to make space. More pliable than pewter, my skin may be less giving. Great discoveries are made on cushioned lessons and hard falls. Sims invents the speculum. I invent the wincing, the if you must of it, the looking away, the here of discovery. We've got the helpless help. Betsy, literally speaking of her helplessness and how she does the work, while Sims uses that spoon, that improvised speculum, to actually invent the speculum, he has to use Betsy's body. She's not necessarily a passive object here. What is interesting here is that she bends herself in ways to open her body to fashion that speculum to its optimum shape so that Sims can basically claim his credit for fashioning an examining instrument to discover, explore the intricacies and the mysteries of the black female body.
I'd like to end on this powerful image of the scientist, the instrument, and the body forming a still life. An atrocious still life, maybe, an awful one that might traumatize people, but still an important artistic still life that kind of asks us, implores us to ask these questions and to tackle these texts and to go back to the notion of what history do we stand on and what's the future that we want to cast around this. And maybe we can close with some little reference. So this is, as we're speaking, this is the day that we're recording this. It's not going to be air today because it's not live, but the day that we're recording this is International Women's Day and it has so many layers, so many meanings. In Germany, it has been relabeled Internationaler Frauenkampftag to call on German white feminist voices to start thinking more intersectionally and to consider fighting not only for white feminist privileges or equalities, but for all people of colors as well. And the structural racism as a concept is only starting to be explored, and there's so much backlash that we are seeing, that I've been seeing in German media these weeks and months. And so trying to silence and to attack Black voices has a history, as our episode today has shown, and it's an important history. And so,
can I just add something here? I just want to come back to what Harriet Washington said about how language is often tortured to disguise the racial nature of hazardous experimentation. And I'd like to just ask us to also think about how language is used in the way we construct knowledge narratives as well. And here I would like to just ask us to think about what June Jordan says about the political uses of poetry and how poetry can be used as sites of critical thinking, of epistemological engagement, and the ways that we take fresh looks at history in order to look at what has been silenced, right? And and June Jordan says, poetry names what has been silenced and allows us to understand and articulate our connections to one another and to the world we inhabit. I think this is something that is also very, very pertinent to all the poetry cycles that we looked at this evening. Mm. And I think this is where, as well, we look at how science, the hard sciences, as well as how the arts can actually provide us with very critical epistemological frames to look at how, you know, social injustice in our times today is being framed, and what kinds of voices are speaking, and who is being heard, and who is being listened to.
Yes. So then we can end on poetry as a site of critical thinking, and literature as a nudging point to make people keep reading and keep thinking and keep engaging.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Christine, for a wonderful conversation.
My pleasure.
Thank you for coming. This has been a long episode, but poetry needs this kind of space. And I'd like to encourage our readers to take a look at the three poetry collections, or at the poets that we've examined, Elizabeth Alexander's The Venus Hottentot, Bettina Judd's Patient, and Marilyn Nelson's Fortune's Bones. Keep reading. Stay happy and healthy, everyone. Thank you, Christine, and have a great evening.
Same here. It was a pleasure indeed. Thank you. Bye-bye. Good night.
Thank you.
Stay safe.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the AmericaZentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.